Did you all find a handout? Did one get to all of you? We're on lesson 22, which is the birth of Moses. We're starting Exodus, finally putting Genesis in our rearview mirror for a while. I thought as our opening, I heard you singing one of my favorite hymns while communion was being distributed. Let's open up our hymnals to hymn 960 and sing one of my favorite hymns. Indulge me, please. Thank you very much, Dr. Bassus.
Okay. I could go on and give the eaters.
I'm sorry, what?
I could give them to the eaters, too.
I'm finding it. Shall we? Isaiah, mighty seer in days of old, the Lord of all in spirit did behold. High on a lofty throne, in splendor bright, with robes that filled the temple courts with light. Above the throne were flaming seraphim. Six wings had they, these messengers of him. With two they veiled their faces as was right. With two they humbly hid their feet from sight. And with the other two aloft they soared. One to the other called and praised the Lord. Holy is God, the Lord of Sabaoth. Holy is God, the Lord of Sabaoth. Holy is God, the Lord of Sabaoth. His glory fills the heavens and the earth. The beams and lentils trembled at their cry, and clouds of smoke enwrap the throne on high. Three holy gods and lords, and yet they are one. The triune God also in the Old Testament. Wonderful. And as we had a Trinitarian, Jesus instituted baptism this morning. Our Bible story is also about a lad that God drew out of the waters and raised him up to be a leader for his people. And so we depart from Joseph's stories and how the children of Israel had gotten into the land of Egypt onto a transition into the book of Exodus. And your triple jeopardy question is, what does Exodus, well, we should do this. What did Genesis mean? What does Genesis mean?
Beginning.
Yeah, beginnings. The genesis of something, it's beginning. And what is Exodus?
Departure.
Departure. Literally, X as in exit. We've got it above our some of our doors, exit. And hodos, which is in Greek, means the way. So it's the way out, the ex-hodos. Jesus in the New Testament is called the hodos, the way. That's what Christianity was originally called. So let's begin. Let's read through Exodus chapter 1, the excerpts that I have recorded for you. And please notice that we are starting at verse 8 in Exodus 1. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Pharaoh. Now what are the kings in Egypt called again? Pharaohs, right. And they all walked like an Egyptian. So there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. So that connotes a time and history change going from Genesis to Exodus. And your quadruple jeopardy question is, how long did the children of Israel remain in Egypt? I thought it was 450. 430? It tells, and we'll get to it. But it's 430, 450, 400 some years. Now that's a long time, right? And this explains to us why a Pharaoh arises who does not know Joseph. There are hundreds of years that went by, and if we study Egyptian history, and there are a lot of mysteries, but Egyptian history is one of the baselines. The history of the ancient world is always tied to the history of Egypt. And if the historians get something wrong about the dating and the history of Egypt, it throws all the dating for ancient history off. And so the Egyptians are a very important culture. And we know that there were various ages in ancient Egypt. There was an early and a medium and an immediate and a modern period. And so this probably denotes a major break in history when a dynasty got discontinued and a new dynasty arose. And that new dynasty would not be familiar with all of the history of the previous dynasty. How much do we understand about American history 400 years before? That would make it around 1620. Oh, that's a familiar date. Isn't that Jamestown, 1620? So we know some things about our ancient history, but not a whole lot. If we didn't talk about very famous names, we wouldn't understand them. And we have had the advantage of having a continuous history here since that time. We don't remember the Indian tribes as we might, because they were displaced people. We displaced them. So there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And by this time, again, Joseph is long dead. And again, I'm going to put the bee in your bonnet. We want to show that Patterns of History video sometime in July. So we'll make that scheduled and advertise it, where it talks about the dating and history and the possible identification of exactly when the Israelites were in and signs of their settlement in Egypt. It's a very interesting documentary. But it sort of revolutionizes the dating that we would expect in Egypt also. So many scholars are very reticent to accept the findings of that documentary. So the debates will go on. Verse 9. And he, the new king, said to his people, "Look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply, and it happen in the event of war, that they also join our enemies and fight against us, and so go up out of the land." So how are the Israelites being viewed by the Egyptians who are in power? They're potential enemies. They're maybe not enemies yet, but they're growing in population, right? What would you say about their status in Egypt? They're going from a minority to the possibility of becoming a majority. Is that happening in the United States? Well, according to a lot of statistics about immigration, they say, but why, what, 2030 or so, there may be more Hispanics and African-Americans than white people. How could that happen? How does that happen? Why is that in America? Yeah, that's a big part of it, right? To replace, and the Boyers are doing such a wonderful job. We all got to take examples of good leadership like that. But the statistics say that we need a replacement rate of 2.2, which means that in every two-parent family, there needs to be 2.2 children to replace the generation that came before. And guess what? We're not doing it. Why not? There's abortion. There's birth control. There's homosexuality. If you mess up the sexual assignments, what does that do to the reproduction rate? Right? Bill and Steve ain't having kids, right? All right. I'm not saying that's what happened in Egypt, but there is something about affluence and wealth. Now, there's nothing wrong with affluence and wealth in and of itself, but the affluent and wealthy tend to get power. And do they tend to be Christian and God-fearing people, or maybe some other sorts of people? What does our money say in it? On it? In God we trust. And what trust, and what God do most people in America trust? Their dollar bills. The thing that says, in God we trust our money. And again, this is, you know, the flesh and spirit dichotomy again, that if we are flesh, we want more money, and we are selfish. And what is the exact opposite of selfishness? It's called parenthood. No, if there is a vocation that teaches you that you're not the most important one in the world, it's the humbling vocation of parenthood. And I see a teacher nodding her head because she's a local parent. What is the term, the Latin for parent? Man, am I losing it? In the local in parentes, thank you very much. In the classroom, right? And you learn who you have to serve. You're not there for them to serve you. If you believe that, you're in for big trouble. But you're serving them. Even by disciplining them, you're serving them. And parenthood is that way. It's a very humbling thing. When that diaper needs changing, someone's got to change it, and there's nobody but you. But if we're selfish, what do we want? We don't want kids. They're a big nuisance. They're an inconvenience. They're a problem. Remember when you were dinks? Dual income, no kids? That's a 70s phrase. Oh, that was a great time in life, right? Then the kids came along. All right, so, but it's happening in Egypt that the Israelites are having lots of kids. Now, is there anything about Israelites that would make them want to have many children? Do they have an ethic? Do the Jews have an ethic of wanting big family and lots of kids? Yeah, where does that come from, right? Right? God promised them, and therefore God promises good things, that your descendants will be as the sand on the beach and as the stars in the heavens. And that's what they wanted. Children were a blessing to them because they knew the one that was blessing them with children. And that makes all the difference for us too. We know that they are a blessing from God. And the most noble job that we have is bringing up that next generation so that they will be God-fearing and will love God as I hope our generation also loves God. Passing that on to them. That was important for the Jews too. And how important was that for the Jews? It was world-shaking in importance, because God not only promised them many descendants, but what would come to the nations from those descendants? A blessing. The Messiah, the blessing. I have lots of kids. I hope this one's it. I hope this one's the Messiah. But the Egyptians are going to deal shrewdly. In other words, they're saying, let's manage this population. Let's do the wise thing with them. Now, they may not have been afraid that the Israelites or Jews were going to rise up in rebellion, but they could be an internal force. They were related to the Canaanites, right? They came from Canaan. That's where their roots were. What if the Canaanites came down and attacked Egypt? Might they not join their kinsmen up in Canaan against Egypt. Remember how we rounded up the Japanese during World War II. Why? Well, because they had kinship with our enemy that attacked Pearl Harbor. So politics is always going to be politics. People, groups, and tribes, and the pride and the dissensions is part of the heritage of Adam's family. Even within his closest family, there was murder between Cain and Abel. And among the tribes, it's going to be the same way. That's the fallenness. Verse 11. Therefore they, the Egyptians, set taskmasters over them to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh supply cities, Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew, and they were in dread of the children of Israel. So the Egyptians made the children of Israel serve with vigor, and they made their lives bitter with hard bondage, in mortar, in brick, and in all manner of service in the field. All their service in which they made them serve was with rigor. Now, how do those last couple verses jive with the Cecil B. DeMille's version of the Ten Commandments and Moses? Anyone remember the old movies? What were the Israelites being used to construct in Cecil B. DeMille's blockbuster epic? Yeah, the pyramids. And again, this is where, what's his name? The Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, Dr. Ben Carson, he says the pyramids were used to store stuff. Now, again, if you put those things together, that sort of fits with what it's saying here. It says that they were making supply cities in Pithom and Ramses, which means they were building warehouses. They were sheds to put supplies in. But does it make sense if they were building pyramids that they were making mortar and bricks and all kinds of manner of service in the field? Yeah, pyramids are quarried stone. They actually had to have some sort of a saw, I think, in order to make them as smooth as they were. But they were primarily quarried stones. They were not bricks. But even to this day, the people in Egypt make buildings out of bricks. Probably the same process that they're talking about. And what they do is they mix, I don't know, mud and stuff, but also hay. You know, when you make wheat, you got the hay that's left over, but that's part of the binding material in the mortar and bricks that they make, and they mix it all together, and then they have forms that they make the bricks in, and then they fire them. And even to this day, they use that manner of construction in Egypt, which evidently the children of Israel were involved in. And so, yeah, it sounds like a terrible, bestial burden to be dragging these stones, however they did it from the quarry on logs or however they did it in their ships. But this is really more expansive. The slaves were used out in the field to grow the wheat and the straw. And they used them then to pick it and to bring it and to mix the mortar and to mix the bricks and then to fire them and construct buildings. And again, it's talking about a lot of Israelites, so many that they're politically afraid of them. Verse 15, then the king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, of whom the name of one was Shiphrah and the name of the other Puah. And he said, when you do the duties of a midwife for the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stools, if it is a son, then you shall kill him. But if it is a daughter, then she shall live. So what's the birth control program in Egypt? You're going to destroy the male children, but leave the female children alive. What is the political strategy with that?
They all have to be killed in the army.
Yeah, it's going to be the males that are going to be the strong men who are going to wield the spears or whatever is needed to man the army. And why aren't they killing the women too? What kind of laborers? Well, the limiting reagent, this is the way chemists talk, the limiting reagent in childbirthing is the number of females. Because men can father countless children in a little amount of time, and a woman can only have one child at a time, and it takes 9 months. So if you want a forced labor force, and you want to keep the population up for that force, you let the women live. If you're afraid of the army, you make the men die. It's interesting. The China one-child policy, which I think was relieved. I think they took it off. But China is going to suffer from that. One child. And what did they want, boys or girls? They wanted boys, and they selectively aborted girls. Not very wise, because now the boys have no one to marry. Fortunately, from what I've heard, they didn't enforce it rigorously in the country, and so many undocumented girls are showing up when the boys want to marry, which just goes to show when the government insists on a policy that is against nature and against man, it will be circumvented, because nature is implanted into everyone. And we're going to see whether the midwives carry this out. The other interesting thing is the birth stool. You know, we go to birthing rooms and women sort of are laying on something with their feet up for the birthing. Well, the birth stool sort of put them into that configuration too. And so they knew how to birth children, and they had midwives to deliver the children. Verse 17, but the midwives feared God. Now, is this the true God or the God of nature? Well, these are probably Jewish midwives, so they feared the real God. They understood that God was behind that life, as our nation is forgetting, right, with its abortion permissions. The midwives feared God and did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the male children alive. So Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, every son who is born you shall cast into the river, and every daughter you shall save alive. So there was genocide decreed for all the boys. And if the midwives weren't going to do it, are the parents more likely to do it? Not likely, but there would be probably some nasty people, maybe Egyptians, who knew that it would be no penalty for them to exterminate those Jews. So, and the question, second last question there is, what was the Egyptian view of an Israelite? How did an Egyptian view an Israelite? As what? A second class citizen. Very good. Not at their level, right? They had rights that the Jews did not. Very good. Maybe can we say something even stronger? That's perfectly right. They saw them as a threat, but how did they view them as people? Mike was on the track of as property or animals. You know, the midwives fear God, which means they believe they had a living soul that was given them by God. Are we permitted to euthanize our puppies and kitties when they get sick? Are we permitted to do that to our parents and grandparents? And why not? Because those are our animals, and our permission to do things with animals is different than our permission to do with other people. And so what I'm suggesting by this is that the Egyptian views the Israelites as animals. Do we use oxen and horses as beasts of burden? Must they do what we say? Yes. And that's exactly how they viewed the Jews, or came to view them as slaves. Now, can you see how insidious the institution of slavery is? And it's a phenomenon of abuse that has been in the human family, I guess, from ancient times. And even now, slavery is practiced in some of the world. And America is not the only nation that practiced slavery in the 18th and 19th centuries. South America exported more slaves, like three times as many slaves from Africa as America did. And another whole slew of them went east into the Orient. It's insidious and terrible, the sins of the human race. And it's found even back here in Egypt. Oh, we have 5 minutes. Then let's save Exodus 2 for next week, and Pastor will give himself a 5-minute hiatus. Let's pause there. This is a good place to stop. Unless there's any... yes, Pastor Wolf. And you know, in that pathway of immigration, I think everybody has sympathy, because that's how our forefathers came. Again, it's famous to talk about the different ethnic groups that came, you know, whether you were Irish or Catholic or whatever they were. But they all came into America understanding that they were going to have the lower echelon work, and the American dream was, we'll work real hard and maybe be able to get some advancement and get a little better for us and our children. And I think that's the American dream that everyone wants for immigrants that come here. It's a complicated issue. For me, the thornier issue is one of human rights. It scares me when some people say, well, these are rights that we Americans have that the immigrants don't have. And what our Constitution says is that these are inalienable rights that God has given to all of his people. And so it bothers me sometimes when I hear people say these are rights that Americans have that other people don't. No, I thought we were talking about human rights. But it gets further confused when there is a right to welfare and that sort of thing. Because that's not what many of the immigrant groups expected or had when they came in. And it has become a right. Instead of a charity, it has become a right. And that's the other factor that confuses things. And some have said, and there is some truth to this, that you can't have open border immigration and a welfare state. You can't have them both. Well, yeah, and I think it may still be on the books as a requirement. But again, I think we have compassion. I guess we could tell all kinds of stories, but I have a friend that got out of the military. It's actually one of his kids got out of the military and wanted to go into business for himself painting houses in upstate New York. And he said the only people that he could hire were illegal immigrants. Because if they were native people that were looking to do that kind of work, they were all drug addicts. But the immigrants were hard workers. You could depend on them being there. You didn't have to pay them a lot. And they were thankful for the work. Who couldn't have compassion for people like that, right? But it's a complicated affair. Yes?
I was wondering, Why did these guys hold off? I mean, especially when they looked like they were starting to make them slaves. Why didn't they just take off and leave before it got too thick?
I have an answer. I don't know if it'll be satisfying. But remember, before Jacob came down, God appeared to him and told him to go. And they were waiting for God to tell them to go. That's the best answer I can give.
Okay.
They were looking for God's direction in that. And evidently, remember, it was a pretty fat city when Pharaoh gave them the choicest of land and a very good position in there. And it's hard to leave when you're doing pretty well. So I think those were some factors for that. We filled up the 5 minutes. God bless you all. Have a good week, and we'll see you next week.